Good morning. First case this morning is United States v. Davis. Appellant ready to argue? The government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Appellant may argue.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Joe Borland, and together with Captain Ben Accinelli, represent the appellant, Nicholas Davis. Chief Judge, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you. The military judge instructed the panel that in order to convict the appellant, the government must prove 4 elements beyond a reasonable doubt. 1, that he knowingly videotaped the private area of J.E. 2, that he did so without her consent. 3, that under the circumstances, J.E. had a reasonable expectation of privacy. And 4, that the accused conduct was wrongful. However, in order to convict the appellant under Article 120 Charlie Alpha 2, the government has the burden of proving that Private Davis subjectively knew that the recording was done without J.E.'s consent. The military judge therefore erred in failing to instruct the panel that such knowledge was necessary to convict the appellant.
Counsel, when you really haven't had a chance to respond to the government's argument that your position is waived because trial defense counsel agreed to jury instructions. What is your response to the waiver argument?
Yes, Your Honor. It may have been forfeited due to a lack of objection, but it was not waived. And Haverty tells us where there's an instructional error, we review, with no objection, we review for plain error.
Well, what are you saying would have, I'm sorry, Chief.
No, same question. Why?
What else would have had to have been done to constitute waiver?
Stand on his head.
Your Honor, even where there, where he does not object, we still review obstructional.
This is more than not objecting. This is not just sitting there keeping silent. This is saying, no, sir, no, sir, 3 bags full. I mean, I don't know what else he can do.
Well, Your Honor, we review the law as it stated is at the time of appeal. So now that we have rehafe, we review that law. And so, therefore, we review this for plain error with our understanding of how the law is now.
Why? You're just saying we do forfeit, but why?
Your Honor, similar cases such as Hukil, where the new law comes out after the trial itself, and therefore we evaluate the case at the time of appeal rather than the case at the time of trial.
Is your point that at the time of trial, the military judge gave the instruction from the military judge's bench book, but now based on the Supreme Court case, that instruction is incorrect?
Precisely, Your Honor. So just merely following the judge's bench book does not relieve them of error in this case. And we would state that the court should follow the law in rehafe and apply knowingly to both elements of the videotaping of the private area of J.E. as well as to the consent. Without this, the panel did not have the opportunity to view the test as a subjective one, but rather as an objectively reasonable test when looking at the consent of Private J.E.
So is it a situation where if rehafe applies, no waiver, but if we find that rehafe is not dispositive of this case, then waiver would apply?
Your Honor, I would not necessarily concede that point because Flores-Figueroa in 2009 does parallel this case. It has a similar statutory construction.
Well, then why, based on that case and based on Alanis, didn't you need to object to trial? Do you see what I'm saying? Like, why is rehafe like somehow some new law that results in a different?
The difference with regard to Alanis is that there was a congressionally mandated mens rea here of knowingly. We need not import a mens rea like we would in those cases, and so we apply knowingly to every element of the offense to separate what's a criminal act from an act that would otherwise not be criminal.
But that doesn't answer the question.
I mean, couldn't you have made the same argument that you're making now before Rehaef, based on the other cases that you cite in your brief?
Yes, Your Honor, it is possible that they could have used the law of Flores-Figueroa at the time of trial.
So let's, assuming that it's not waived, why doesn't the fact that the known or reasonably should have known language in 120C-A3 militate against us importing those words into A1 and A2?
Your Honor, because knowingly is placed in front of the entire paragraph, which applies to all elements of the offense. And so the reasonably should have known is a reasonable person's standard with an objective review rather than a subjective standard from the appellant's state of mind, if you report knowingly without the JE's consent.
Captain Borland, can you respond to the government's attempt to distinguish the Rehaef case? They point out that in the Rehaef case, the verb sort of jumped over the status element and then attached to the possession element. And they say in this case, it would be sort of awkward to interpret the knowingly to apply both to a verb that he knowingly photographed and then to the adverbial phrase without consent. And I think the long and the short of it is that in the government's position, knowingly would just logically stop at the comma before you got to the adverbial phrase. And it really wasn't like that in Rehaef, where it seemed like it all flowed together.
Yes, Your Honor, and I would remind you, or I would simply state that we need not be a panel of grammarians, and their reliance on that and their distinguishment with reliance on Price is fraught with peril. One, Price was a 2-1 decision, and the one judge followed along with a judge who unfortunately passed away while they were writing the opinion, and he basically cut and pasted that opinion, disagreeing with how they evaluated the statute. And two, since Rehaef came out, the Eighth Circuit ordered additional briefing sua sponte of the parties to discuss how Rehaef impacts their case.
What about the element under circumstances in which that other person has a reasonable expectation of privacy? Does that have to be knowingly as well?
Your Honor, we believe it does. However, there is instructional error because the second element of without consent wasn't given with a knowingly instruction. So the analysis could stop there, or it could reach the with reasonable expectation of privacies as well.
How would the meaning of this have changed if the comma was not in one there? Knowingly and wrongfully views the private area of another without the other person's consent. There was no comma there between person and without. How would this statute change in meaning?
Your Honor, I believe if it was constructed that way and maybe had a semicolon after without consent, you would read knowingly into both videotaping as well as without consent. However, here, the panel did not see the statute. The panel received the instructions, and the instructions separated those elements and only used knowingly, videotaped the private area of JE, followed that by a semicolon, and moved on to another phrase, so it's clear that the judge did not instruct the panel correctly by not including knowingly without her consent.
So should that comma not be considered interruptive punctuation, where the knowingly then does not spread out over the rest of that provision?
Your Honor, because an element of the offense is without her consent, the comma is of no import when we look at Rehaef and Flores-Figueroa. We need to apply the mens rea to every element of the offense, which constitutes the completed action of the offense.
Well, but in order to do that, I think we might, in fact, have to be grammarians, potentially, right? If you're trying to say that this statute is like or not like the statutes in those cases?
Yes, Your Honor, we do have to look at the construction of the statute and the statutory construction principles, but we can rely on Rehaef and Flores-Figueroa to see that the mens rea needs to apply to every element of the offense.
So are you reading Rehaef broadly, where essentially what that means is going forward with any statute, if at some point Congress has inserted the mens rea, it applies to everything within that statute?
No, Your Honor. And, in fact, if you flipped this statute and had the consent element as well as the under reasonable expectation of privacy before knowingly came into play, then knowingly would only apply to the video recording piece. But because it comes first, it then it attaches to all of the following on actions, which makes this offense a crime.
Captain Borland, getting back to Figueroa. Now, there were two concurring opinions, I believe, one from Justice Alito and one from Justice Scalia. And I know they're concurring opinions, but didn't they make the point or try to make the point that context matters, that there is a general presumption that a statute like this where a knowledge element is present modifies all the other elements, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
But didn't they make the point that, hey, look, that needn't be the case in every case? I mean, it's a general presumption, but there are certainly other instances, and I think in one of those concurring opinions there is a long string cite of cases cited where the general presumption did not apply. What do you think about their two opinions? Because I noticed the majority they acknowledged the concurring views, but they didn't reject them.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think there could be statutory constructions where it wouldn't necessarily apply, but it fits well here, and I would posit that the linchpin of the offense is that this recording was done without her consent. And so to not apply that mens rea to the act, to the actual thought of what was going on in the mind of Davis at the time of the offense is what makes it criminal.
Well, I noticed that a number of these cases where the knowledge element exists, it's usually a situation where the courts have said, hey, look, the accused must have knowledge, and there's this thing out there that they can, you know, whether it's the ID of another, of an unauthorized person, or whether it's an ID of an actual person. There's no thing here. Consent isn't really a tangible thing.
You're correct, Honor, that it's not tangible. However, both sides can use circumstantial evidence and the facts and circumstances surrounding the event to either prove or disprove.
No, what I'm saying is that the cases I think I read, the object was something, you know, that you actually, it made sense to have to know about, you know, like I said, the ID, the whether the ID was that of a real person. And there are a bunch of these kinds of examples, but that doesn't seem to fit this situation. I can't, in my mind, see how consent is a thing where the accused would have to have the actual knowledge of.
Your Honor,
do you know what I'm asking?
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm being a little vague.
I believe that it could be paralleled to a status. So whether you're consenting or not is a status, and similarly in Rehafe, whether or not you're an illegal alien is a status.
But in Rehafe, wasn't the statute or statutory situation very different? I mean, you had actually two statutes. It had the statute that said those who were, anyone who has knowledge of this, this, and this, and this, and this was in another statute, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And that
so the things you had to have knowledge of were contained in another statute or another part of the statutory scheme. That's very different than this situation, is it not?
Well, Your Honor, I would posit that that makes it even more attenuated, and here it's even more clear that Congress intended to have the mens rea for this offense to be knowingly, and for that knowingly mens rea to apply to all elements of the offense.
Judge Ryan is going to ask you in a minute, but give me one more question. The other thing I wondered about is whether or not we all know what the elements of the offense are, but does it matter that the specification actually alleged a wrongful and knowing action here on the part of the accused? In other words, if we are to define wrongfulness as without legal justification or excuse, then does that help you or hurt you or affect your argument in any way?
Because that was the fourth element of the offense, Your Honor, and we first view it through a lens through the second element of an objective test instead of a subjective test, I don't believe we get there. And in fact, it doesn't push them one way or the other.
If it has to be wrongful, doesn't that separate innocent from criminal behavior?
Yes, Your Honor, if done knowingly without the consent of the of J.E.
So, you can address this on rebuttal. What, if, even assuming that it's not waived and even assuming that we agree with you about what knowingly modifies, in terms of it being harmful or harmless, what are we to make of the testimony of Agent Lee, where he said that your client told him that he did not have her consent?
Your Honor, I can see I'm running out of time. I have time.
Answer the question.
Your Honor, that was a given in a following the alleged incident in CID. It was a simple question where did you have her consent, and he said I did not. We believe that can be construed and argued as he did not have her affirmative consent. However, if the proper instruction were given, the defense could have argued to the panel that based on the facts and circumstances surrounding the incident, he could have had her implied consent.
She impliedly consented to it?
Yes, Your Honor. That's at least could have been argued and was due to the
could have been argued. Was it argued?
It was not argued was because not argued. We did not have the proper instruction.
In terms of the lack of proper instruction, trial defense counsel did not ask for that instruction.
That is correct, Your Honor.
What canon of statutory construction do you rely on in your reading of this statute?
Your Honor, we would rely on the plain reading of the statute.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Stuckey, judges of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Brian Jones. Major Craig Shapiro and I represent the United States. For two reasons, this court should affirm the judgment of the Army Court. First, appellant affirmatively waived this issue, leaving no error to correct on appeal. And second, assuming plain error review applies, appellant cannot demonstrate a clear, obvious, and prejudicial error because neither the text of the statute nor the Supreme Court's holding in Rehafe require a knowledge mens rea with respect to consent. Turning first to waiver, this is not a case of silence or a mere failure to object without more. This is a case of contemplative speech and action. When on two occasions, in response to specific questioning from the military judge, the defense counsel stated that he had no objections and no changes to the military judge's proposed findings instructions. Additionally, this was not a decision that was made in the heat of advocacy. The record indicates that 2 hours elapsed between the initial colloquy and the second colloquy, and that both times prior to answering the question for the military judge, the defense counsel conferred with his co-counsel. Taken together, this indicates a voluntary abandonment of a known right. This court should find affirmative waiver, and this would be the most narrow way for this court to dispose of
it. I'm curious about one thing. You did not raise in your brief the issue of affirmative waiver until page 23. Seemingly, you didn't have any confidence in that argument. It would seem that that's something that would have been raised at the very beginning.
We have full confidence in that argument, Judge Olson, but I wanted to just make sure that in the summary of the argument that we addressed the issue specified by the court, and that's why we dropped the footnote in the summary of the argument paragraph to direct the court to our argument on affirmative waivers. So to the extent members of the court wanted to just flip and read that portion of the argument, they certainly could. And additionally, we highlighted the facts indicating affirmative waiver in our facts section, Your Honor. Turning next, assuming this court does not find affirmative waiver, this pushes us into plain error review with the burden on the appellant to demonstrate that an error occurred, that it was clear and obvious, and that it was prejudicial. Here, there was no error because the text of the statute criminalizes an accused who knowingly records and knows that what he is recording is the private area of another person. But knowledge does not extend further than that, and it does not apply to the adverbial phrase without that other person's consent. In the government's view, this is the most natural grammatical reading of the statute. It raises no substantial constitutional questions or creates positively absurd results, which are the two concerns that the Supreme Court was worried about in Excitement Video. Rehafe does not compel a different result. Rehafe is distinguishable for at least four reasons. Number one, as Judge Sparks noted earlier, Rehafe is two statutes working in tandem. 924 is criminalizing the conduct listed in 922 Gulf. I would submit that the statutory construction in this case is a much easier lift for this court. We just have the plain language of the statute, and the most natural reading does not suggest that a knowledge mens rea applies to the post-object phrase without that other person's consent. Additionally, Rehafe, the clear holding of Rehafe is that it is its application to status rather than conduct-based offenses. This is a conduct-based offense. It is, the accused's conduct is criminal, regardless if he is a junior enlisted soldier, an NCO, a commissioned officer, a married person, it doesn't matter. The conduct is criminal regardless of status. And additionally, the status element in Rehafe was the crucial element, as the court said, that distinguished lawful from innocent conduct. Turning to point three, despite status being this the crucial element that distinguished lawful from innocent conduct, as noted in the slip opinion at page two, Mr. Rehafe was deprived of the opportunity to contest that element at trial because the district court judge instructed the jury that the government did not need to prove Mr. Rehafe knew his status as an unlawful alien.
Counsel, with respect to waiver, if appellant is right about knowingly needing to have been instructed on, if that's a proper construction of the statute, do you agree or disagree that the military judge was under a duty to instruct on that, whether he was requested to or not, under RCM 920?
I would agree that he does have a sua sponte duty to instruct, Your Honor.
And under Davis, under our case in Davis, where we talked about the fact that instructions are required under RCM 920, and mere failure to object without more constitutes forfeiture, not waiver. So what was there beyond the mere failure to object here that would constitute waiver?
Your Honor, I think the fact that that there were two colloquies with the military judge, that he had the defense counsel was posed the question two different times. One time it was a preliminary discussion. The second question was after the proposed findings instructions had actually been provided to the counsel. Additionally, the fact that both times defense counsel conferred with his co-counsel, indicating that this was not a decision that was perhaps just made in the heat of advocacy. And additionally, the fact that under RCM 920 Charlie, it's incumbent upon defense counsel to be prepared to discuss proposed findings instructions, and if they so desire, to request modified or different instructions than what the standard instructions are in the military bench book. So I would agree that in a case where it's just perhaps there's no objection, or perhaps it's just a fleeting comment of no objection, that may not amount to affirmative waiver under this court's opinion in Davis, which clearly indicates that it's got to be something more than that. And in this case, I think you take the facts as in the totality, and that demonstrates a voluntary abandonment of a known right.
Counsel, let me ask you about your absurdity argument. At the end of your brief, you suggest that appellant's construction of the statute would lead to absurd results because, for example, it would allow voluntary intoxication to negate liability because if you were so confused that you didn't know, then the element wouldn't be satisfied. But couldn't that be turned around also such that even if the accused, put it a different way, if the accused reasonably believed the person consented or had reason to believe that they would still be guilty because they didn't, because the standard is there's essentially no mens rea without consent. I mean, is it the government's position that even if you have reason to believe that there's consent, that it doesn't matter because there's no mens rea?
No, that's not the government's position, Judge Maggs. In this case, unlike Mr. Rehafe, the appellant in this case had essentially two layers of protection that distinguished to make sure that only criminal conduct was actually criminalized. Number one, the government had to prove objectively beyond a reasonable doubt in its prima facie case that the victim did not consent. And then in this case, Private Davis availed himself of the mistake of fact as to consent element, requiring the government to come over the top and disprove that he did not have an honest and reasonable, that is, non-negligent, mistake of fact as to her consent. Neither of those defenses were available to Mr. Rehafe in his trial, but they were in this case because those layers of protection are built into the structure of the statute.
Why would mistake of fact apply if there's no mental state required for that last element?
I read this court's opinion in McDonald to indicate that based on the congressional definition of consent, that an accused under 120 Fox and under 916, that they still can avail themselves of a mistake of fact to say that they had an honest and non-negligent mistake with respect to that, and that would be an affirmative defense. Turning to prong two of the plain error analysis, even if there was error in this case, it was not plain at the time of appeal. The only military case court to have addressed this issue was the Air Force Court in the Besmertny opinion, which was appended to the government's brief, and they held that this decision, that the statute at issue did not require a knowledge mens rea with respect to consent. So I read this court's opinion in Gonzalez to indicate that this issue, like it was in Gonzalez, is subject to reasonable dispute both at the time of trial and on appeal, and therefore appellant would fail under prong two. Appellant would also fail to establish prejudice in this case, because his client admitted to CID that he made the recording without Private J.E.'s consent, that testimony was admitted at trial. Additionally, we have the testimony of Private J.E., who discusses the sexual conduct but indicates that at no time did she see appellant video recording her, at no time did she give consent to appellant video recording her, and then we have appellant's behavior after sort of surreptitiously showing this video to his friend and then deleting it from his phone. Together this all indicates that appellant, even if he was subjective knowledge of non-consent was required, he had it in this case. There are no further questions of the court. The United States asks this court to affirm the judgment of the Army Corps.
Thank you, counsel. Does the appellant have rebuttal?
No rebuttal, Your Honor.
Thank you. Case is now submitted. Court thanks counsel for both sides. Court is in recess until 9:40.